Thank you for coming. I want to thank Jorge for organizing this and for inviting me to participate. Let me start just by saying a couple of words about the Union of Concerned Scientists, where I work. We are a science-based environmental advocacy organization. We take the science very seriously. We take our engagement with the research community beyond UCS very seriously for two reasons. One is that helps us to make sure that our advocacy work is grounded as well as it can possibly be in sound science and in current science. And it also gives us an opportunity to help the research community more broadly engage at the policy interface, and I'll say a little bit more about that later on. So before I talk to you about agricultural policy and greenhouse gas mitigation, I want to talk to you about bicycles for just a minute. I like to commute on my bicycle. My bicycle was stolen recently. I was upset about it. But a couple years ago, I had the opportunity to go to Amsterdam, which, unlike Washington, D.C., where I live, is a really bicycle-friendly city. And that's where I took this picture. And I was just ecstatic. I got off the train, and there's bicycles everywhere. And so my point in showing you this is that, you know, I have some hope that Washington, D.C. down the road will look a lot more like Amsterdam, will be a lot more bicycle friendly. In the meantime, I'm hoping that we can put in a few more bike lanes. We have a bike share system. We have these incremental gains that we're making. But really, we're hoping for a transformative change in D.C. where we have a really bicycle friendly city. And everything I say from here on out in this talk about agricultural policy and greenhouse gas mitigation and conservation is oriented in that same framework. Yes, we're working for some incremental change and improvement, but really what we're looking for is transformative change on the landscape. We're not satisfied with the ag landscape we have today. And so if you aren't with me on that kind of optimistic, transformative viewpoint, then I've probably lost you right now. And you can go have a cup of coffee, and I won't be offended. So as Jorge did a great job laying out, you know, you're looking at a cornfield over a season, spring in the left where they're at planting, in a tiled rain system maybe 1,000 miles from here in Illinois or Minnesota to the north and a little bit to the east. In the fall, you can see, again, a lot of water coming out of the tile drain, the red dots representing nitrogen in the soil. Often these cornfields are fertilized in the fall, so lots of nitrogen coming out in the drainage water in the fall. And there's lots of things that we can do to improve nitrogen retention in these systems. And Jorge talked about some of them. You can fertilize less. You can split your application. You can use a slow-release fertilizer. There are some questions about where to draw the boundaries on this system from a greenhouse gas accounting standpoint, because in fact these cornfields don't exist isolated. They're tied to a fertilizer factory. The fertilizer factory is tied to natural gas wells, and so the fossil carbon is going from the natural gas well to the fertilizer factory out the smokestack of the fertilizer factory, and then the nitrogen is going on to the farm field. So if you use less fertilizer, you know, you're maybe reducing your N2O emissions from the fields, particularly in the spring or the fall. In the middle of the growing season, you've got more rooting activity, right, so more nitrate uptake, so less nitrate available for loss. But if you do cut your fertilizer use, who gets credit for the CO2 emissions that you didn't have from the factory? And can you even count on that happening? Can you count on less fertilizer use meaning less fertilizer production? Seems like you ought to be able to, but that's not a settled question. I want to argue also that none of these approaches that I just mentioned are the best things that we could do. The best thing we could do might be to not have corn here at all. The best thing we might be doing is, instead of growing corn, most of which goes to animal feed and ethanol right now, is to grow, say, a mixture of orchard grass and timothy grass, which can also be used as a forage. There's multiple cuttings per year. It doesn't tend to be fertilized, hence no fertilizer factory, no natural gas well in the background. Much deeper, richer rooting system. It's perennial, so those roots are active a much longer period of time. Or you could just put animals on the land. Hard to imagine doing that on prime farmland in Iowa or Illinois, but this is not. One more example of a way that we can do something quite a bit differently than we normally do now, unpublished data from Jennifer Gardner and Megan Schapansky. The Midwest fields on the left, fields in New York State on the right, showing the x-axis legume nitrogen as a proportion of total nitrogen input. And what you see is that the system gets tighter as the legumes become more important sources of nitrogen in the system. So the more your nitrogen inputs are coming from legumes, the less nitrogen you have leaking out of the systems, according to these data. So I just wanted to show you those two examples, one illustrated in the painting of the Timothy grass alfalfa grass system, one in these data from legumes in New York State in the Midwest, suggesting that we don't have to have an agricultural landscape with 90 million acres of corn, and that we can do better from a nutrient loss point of view, and probably from an N2O loss point of view. I want to take a step back for just a second. There's a lot of attention on, and this whole session is on greenhouse gas mitigation and agriculture. Is agriculture the main driver of ecosystem services broadly, or of climate change? I would say, of ecosystem services broadly, yes, it dominates our landscapes. You know, go to the Gulf of Mexico or to the Chesapeake Bay and say agriculture isn't a dominant driver of the problems we're experiencing in those ecosystems. Hard to do. Potential impact of changing our ag practices, of improving conservation management in agriculture, very high. In climate change, I would argue that's not the case. In climate change, I would argue agriculture is not the main driver. Some, you might argue it's a modest driver, and the potential impact is maybe a little bit higher because maybe we can actually do a little bit better with ag offsetting than we can with the ag as a main driver. But I think we need to keep this in mind because over the last several years, we've seen report after report on greenhouse gas mitigation potential in U.S. forestry and agriculture. You know, there were two more recently, one in this book on crops and carbon, another from CAST. I can't keep up with them. They come so fast and furious, and they're all big, thick books. You know, they're making my shelves droop, and I want to read them. They look fascinating. But why so much attention on ag as a greenhouse gas mitigation strategy when I've just asserted that it's not the main driver of climate change? And I'm going to give you one hypothesis. This was language from a bill introduced into the Senate a couple of years ago, and when we were all hopeful we would have comprehensive climate and energy legislation. This is the section on establishment of a domestic offsets program. And I'll say a little bit more about offsets in a little while. And there's a list of eligible projects, a lot of emphasis on agriculture here that I've excerpted for you. Tillage, cover cropping, fertilizer management, certified organic farms, animal management. This isn't saying you all of these would have to be qualify as offsets. It's saying you'd have to at least consider them all. And so you can accept the hypothesis or not that this momentum, the need to A, have votes from ag states, B, the need to get as much broad public support as we possibly could to try to pass this legislation, maybe is part of what led to all of this interest that we're seeing. Even if you don't accept that causality hypothesis, that is at least another indicator of the amount of momentum that this has received. So the question is, now that we're on this train, is it taking us where we want to go? And I want to try to keep that in mind through the rest of this talk. I want to talk about now a couple of specific policy arenas. The first relates to some work I've been involved in with the Climate Action Reserve. And I need to say at the outset that I'm not speaking on behalf of the Reserve at all. Its staff, its policies, these are purely my own observations having been involved in this process. The Climate Action Reserve is based in California. It's a not-profit organization, and it exists to develop carbon offset protocols. Its primary client is the Air Resources Board of the state of California, which is administering AB 32, which is the climate protection law in California, which includes a carbon offsets program. So here is the one place in the United States where we actually do have a carbon offsets program with a market. The first thing the Climate Action Reserve has a number of different protocols. They have one for nitric acid production. I think they have one for landfill methane. They are now trying to develop some for agriculture. One of them is for carbon sequestration in soil. One of them is for rice management. One of them is for nitrogen management. When they begin to develop a protocol, one of the things they do is they hire a consulting firm to begin doing some background research for them that will ultimately draft the protocol. They also convene a multi-stakeholder working group, which I was participating on, and they convene a science advisory committee, which Peter, who gave the last talk, was on, and Neville, you here yet? Yeah, Neville also has been on this working group with me. And so it's been very interesting to be involved in this group and watch how this process has evolved over time. And I'm going to just share some highlights. we had, in one of the first meetings we had, we were shown this graph, and we were told, look at the bottom two lines. Nitrogen fertilizer use over time from 1964 to 2006 has remained pretty constant, maybe even declined a little bit in recent years. Corn yields have continued to go up. The reserve staff looked at this and said, okay, we're looking at this to say that if a farmer decreases their fertilizer application rates, we're going to look at that as above and beyond business as usual, okay, above baseline. And they're very concerned because what they don't want to be doing is giving credits to somebody for something that they would have done anyway. And we had a very interesting discussion about this, and is that good enough or not? Because maybe overall in the United States, nitrogen fertilizer rates are flat, but maybe in some states they're actually going down. So if I'm a farmer in a state where they're going down, can I get credit for doing what I would have done anyway? So we had a very interesting discussion about this kind of thing, and it was a very useful place for a lot of different stakeholders, including the research community, to weigh in. They gave us a list of practices. They said, here's a bunch of practices we're thinking about considering as offsets under this protocol. Should we use all of them? Should we delete some of them? Should we add some of them? Again, we had a very interesting discussion about this, and it was an important place for the research community to weigh in on this process in a legitimate and impactful way. They had a number of initial proposed requirements, and I'm just giving you some illustrations here. I'm not in any way trying to give you a comprehensive run-through of this process. But one of their proposed requirements is that specific practices adopted and maintained on individual fields with at least five fields combined to define a project. Well, should it be five fields? The idea is you can then capture some more heterogeneity. You don't deal with as much idiosyncratic, but maybe you'd have one really big field instead of five small fields. Is this the right way to design this policy? They also said that we should have at least some number of approved nutrient management changes on each field, one of which had to be a reduction in fertilizer application rate. So that means you're a farmer. If you want to participate in this program, you have to reduce your application rate, and then you also have to do a couple of other things. One thing more, two things more, three things more. And again, the reasoning behind this was to ensure that whatever you were giving credit for was additional, that it's unlikely that a farmer would have made three practice changes anyway. And we had, again, a very interesting discussion about this. There's this idea of a cultivation cycle, which in how are you going to do your accounting? And there was language in the proposed draft that a cultivation cycle would be the period starting immediately after a harvest and ending at the end of the next calendar year's harvest. One of our working group members, Christina Tenito, brought up the point that that doesn't really work if you're using certain kinds of 2 or 3 year rotations, because you might not be on a 12-month cycle. You might have your cover crop in the ground at the end of 12 months, and maybe the next change comes at the end of 15 months, and at the end of 2 or 3 years, you're back on your annual cycle, but not in the middle. This definition turned out also to be important for the way that the model that we're thinking of using to estimate greenhouse gas budgets was constructed. So I think we've now succeeded in relaxing and changing this definition to accommodate a wider diversity of ag practices and ag systems in this protocol. Does participating in an offset foreclose other options? Remember the first couple of slides I showed you, contrasting a conventional corn system in a tile-drained landscape, which we know is very leaky, with a Timothy alfalfa field. The language in this protocol initially said the same cropping production system needed to be used throughout the 5 years of the contract. Well, is that a good thing? It probably means you're going to get an incremental improvement because of the way that the additionality concerns have been addressed, but it also means that 2 years in, I can't decide to use a long rotation or grow millet instead of corn. So is it locking us in to something to get an incremental improvement where we could maybe have gotten a much broader improvement like that? So some key developments. First, there's a much greater emphasis on ensuring that each practice rests on a solid base of data than we had originally. I didn't talk about that much just now, but it's certainly been my observation, and I think Neville would agree with this. Second, it lets go of the assumption that a process-based model returns more accurate emission estimates than regression models. Something that was a surprise, I think, to the reserve staff, but something that both of these working groups managed to convince them of. Third, we have a much smaller list of practices than we did initially because of the need to quantify how much emission reductions you get for a particular change in practice. And the last is a much greater emphasis on a process for evaluating additional practices as new data emerge, in part because we see this sort of surge of interest in measuring N2O in response to different conservation management practices. So the process seems to have worked, at least so far. This protocol will be released sometime in 2012, probably in the first half of 2012. You know, they put together this protocol, they convened these working groups, got lots of input, made lots of revisions based on the input, including a lot of science-based input. But are we getting where we really want to go? Are we going down the track that we were on in the first place without really thinking about it, or are we really getting where we need to go? So a couple of things we want to keep in mind. Here's our farmer on a field, right? Cornfield, soy field, feeding into a beef cattle operation in the back, making some changes to increase, in this case, decrease N2O emissions. Why? It's a trade, right? And we can lose sight of this. It's not just this extra benefit we're getting in this case. We're working under a cap and trade system, right? With offsets, it's not just a benefit. It's a trade. We are allowing that coal plant to release CO2 that otherwise would have been regulated in exchange for this farmer using less fertilizer, using a split application, doing a spring application instead of a fall application. That's the trade. What are the pluses? Well, it's fairly cheap to do ag greenhouse gas mitigation practices compared to most other. We can do it pretty fast. It doesn't take a farmer that long with the right kind of support to make these changes. What are the minuses? I described this possibility of a lockdown being constrained into an incremental change that's beneficial and not being able to make a more transformative change. And it's also possible that in incentivizing these very narrow set of practices that require such strict quantification, you lose other ecosystem services. You know, Jorge mentioned at the beginning, we all know how long it takes to build an inch of soil. Right? Do you want to incentivize some narrow set of practices? What about all of the other practices that we would like to see on the landscape for all of those other ecosystem services, of which ag is a much bigger driver than climate change? And this is to remind me to say a little bit, to make the point about quantification that I did a minute ago. So I don't need to do that anymore. There's one last point I want to make. I don't hear this talked about very much. I'd be interested in other people's thoughts on it. The idea of competitive advantage. I don't think farmers are anticipated to make these changes if they're just going to break even. Right? So now you are incentivizing a group of growers to, say, use less fertilizer. A good thing. You know, no, I'm not arguing with that at all. Now you have somebody who wants to go from a 2-year rotation to a 4-year rotation. Are they going to be able to do it? Are they going to be at a greater competitive disadvantage than they otherwise would have been? Not because their 4-year rotation isn't a good idea, but because we can't quantify the benefits of that rotation and pay for it the same way that we can quantify and pay for the benefits of reduced fertilizer application. It's not because it's a less good idea. It's not because it might not deliver as many or more benefits. It's because we haven't studied it as much, and it's because it's harder to quantify. So do you actually end up with a bit of a perverse incentive here? So that's all I'm going to say about the Climate Action Reserve process for now, other than they have just released a rice cultivation protocol. It's on their website. It's open for public comment. I would encourage all of you to participate in that, and I would encourage all of you also to participate in the public comment period on the nitrogen management protocol when it's released sometime in 2012. So I've been talking mostly about the reduced N2O emissions on the right. I want to say a little bit about soil carbon storage to get at a question that came up in the last session, in the last talk. There's at least two criteria you need to meet in order to have one of these protocols in an offset program. And the first is permanence. The idea is that these offsets should be permanent. I don't see any way that we're ever going to be able to say that soil carbon storage is permanent. Maybe for deep-rooted plants, if you could estimate how much carbon you're going to store a meter below the soil, maybe you could make an argument that that's not going to go away. In the surface, 10 centimeters, we know you come along after 10 years, you plow up the soil. It's really hard for me to see how you're going to get away from that problem. In the context of an offset program where you're trading for not burning a ton of coal. Right? I'm not arguing that we should not build soil carbon. Building soil organic matter has lots of great ecosystem services, lots of value to human well-being, and absolutely we should be doing it. The knowledge base for quantifying soil carbon storage, I have a big question mark on, and I think I'm going to skip over that section in the interest of time, but I'd love to talk to people about it afterwards. For reduced N2O emissions, I think the permanence question is solved, because if you don't emit the N2O this year, it's not likely that you're going to emit extra N2O next year. So I think you're okay with the permanence criterion. Our knowledge base is a little bit thin because we haven't been measuring N2O emissions at the right temporal and spatial scales for very long, but that's something we can do something about, and as we're seeing at other sessions in this meeting, it's something we are doing something about, including many of the people in this room now. I'm going to skip over these in the interest of time. Here's another kind of policy that we could use to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture. This is the production tax credit for biofuels through 2015. Most of that goes to corn ethanol. If you can change that tax credit, have a lot less of that going to corn ethanol, this is not a food security issue, right? Corn-based ethanol is widely regarded as not a great idea. That would be an important policy driver. It doesn't require this quantification problem, solving the quantification problem that's implicit in the offsets. It's not a place that the ag community has put a lot of effort, but if you're going to have to choose where to put your advocacy effort if you want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture, this wouldn't be a bad place to think about. Now I want to talk a little bit about the Farm Bill, which we've heard about a little bit already. This is something that's receiving a lot of attention in Washington and other places around the country at this point. It will continue to for a little while longer. We don't know exactly how much longer. This is a big money bill. This is at least a $60 billion a year bill. How big is NSF's annual budget? How big is the Ag Research Service's annual budget? How big is NIFA's annual budget? Maybe a couple of billion? This is a $60+ billion a year bill. And it's going to pass. It's not really any question. It always passes. So about a third of that goes to what we think of agriculture, about two-thirds goes to what we think of as nutrition programs, which includes food stamps and school lunch programs, things like that. I'm going to talk a little bit about the conservation programs and the crop insurance programs. Conservation programs first. They're divided up into several different components here. The working lands programs and the retirement programs. The retirement programs, things like the conservation reserve program, where you're taking land out of production. At UCS, we focus most on the working lands programs, which are ways of creating more sustainable agriculture while continuing to produce food, which is what our agricultural lands are mainly for and which we need them to do. First thing I want you to notice about this is that between 2002 and now, the working lands program funding has increased dramatically. And I think this is instructive when you think about what we might look towards in the future. You know, there's all kinds of programs that you might not have even thought of or that just seem small now that could be much bigger and much more important in the future than they are now. The Working Lands Program is now a really important part of the conservation title in the Farm Bill. And I want to give you just one brief vignette to illustrate how this program actually, one of these programs, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, which is on the left there, actually works on the ground. This is a story from the north coast of California, small organic dairies. There was an understanding that the EPA was going to institute total maximum daily load requirements in these watersheds. Clearly, these dairies were going to be out of compliance, and they wanted to get ahead of the game and do something before they got in trouble. And a number of these dairies went and they got EQIP grants, which tend to be infrastructure grants, and they use them to buy high-quality diesel engines. They use them to buy these traveling irrigator guns that can go out on the land even when it's wet because they don't weigh that much. The big problem they've got is manure management, not surprisingly, on these lands. And so this is a way for them to spread their manure on the land at a time of the year when it makes sense. It costs them about $150,000 for the technology, and they got improved manure management out of the deal, and everybody was happy. So how do you suppose this happened? Did each of these farmers individually maybe get approached by an extension agent who said, you know, there's something, we want to tell you about this TMDL, and by the way, just go and apply for this grant at the NRCS? Turns out it's much more confusing than that, right? So in this case, the linchpin, in my understanding of this, and somebody else might tell the story differently, this is how I heard the story, is that what was key is a staff person at a local resource conservation district who was in touch with EPA, knew what was happening with the TMDLs, who also was in touch with the NRCS, knew what was needed in order for these farmers to get EQIP funding, could go to the state agencies to get matching funding because the EQIP funding by itself wasn't really going to be enough to do the job properly, knew enough about which project engineers in that area were really good and could come and do the work properly, and had a trusting relationship with the farmers, where she could go to the farmer and say, look, here's what's going to happen if you don't do anything. I can help you. I can help you keep your operation financially viable and sound, but here's what you got to do. And you got to commit to me that if you do this, you're going to let other growers onto your land to see what you've done so that we can expand this kind of practice in this region. So on the ground, if I had to make one policy recommendation based on this vignette, I would say what you want is to make sure that resource conservation districts and other on-the-ground staff have enough support that this kind of information network can continue. And this is not a one-off. I haven't done a national survey or anything, but we found the same thing. This is from the state of Maryland. In other places where the legislative intent is to provide sufficient technical assistance for conservation planning, and the legislative finding was inadequate resources to hire field personnel to help farmers prepare conservation plans. So that's at a very on-the-ground level. Let me just say a little bit about what's happening at kind of a more abstract level, the kind of level that we more often work at the Union of Concerned Scientists, in my program anyway. What's happening with the Farm Bill now? What should we expect to see? And what should you be thinking about as you decide, as individuals, where to engage and on these issues? First, we're looking at a likely merger of a number of conservation programs, including the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, which I just talked about a little bit, and the Conservation Stewardship Program. This could be done well, or it could be done poorly. We don't want to just lose conservation initiatives in the process. We might be able to make it more efficient, and we might be able to make it easier for farmers to participate. These are four people who you probably don't recognize all of, but you might want to start recognizing in the future. The committee chair and ranking member for the House Ag Committee and the Senate Ag Committees. I'm putting this up for two reasons. One is you might have seen in the New York Times yesterday an article that these four sent a letter to the Deficit Reduction Committee, the so-called Super Committee, offering $23 billion in reduction that they would propose to receive $23 billion less in ag funding, and that by the end of the month they will send a more detailed recommendation. And the reason they're doing this is they're trying to be preemptive and have a little bit more control over exactly where ag loses funding, because it's going to lose funding. We're going to be in a budget-constrained environment, and we're going to be playing defense on a lot of these conservation programs. At least that's our expectation through this Farm Bill. And it's ours, I say, UCS's, but also the sustainable ag conservation community in general. And I said I wanted to say a little bit about crop insurance. Here's Spaceman Spiff. You know, if you own this spaceship, I always carry insurance on my spaceship. I carry the best insurance I can on my spaceship, and I'm guessing Spiff does also. And if you're a grower, you probably want to have crop insurance. And it's worth thinking about crop insurance as a driver of conservation and greenhouse gas mitigation, among other things, for a minute, because the direct subsidy payments that farmers have received have at least some tie to a conservation requirement. You can't receive direct subsidy payments unless you are complying at least to some minimum degree with conservation practices. And that's a reasonable, in our estimation, many other people's estimation, a very reasonable requirement. It's public money, you're receiving public money, and it's reasonable that you give something back to the greater good. Crop insurance is not the same. Crop insurance is heavily subsidized by the federal government. You then buy it as a grower from a private company, but because it's heavily subsidized, you're getting a product for much less than its value, than its true value, which means you're likely to buy it, right? You know, if I'm saying, I will subsidize all of your dinners tonight at the finest restaurant in town, that restaurant is going to make a killing. And similarly, the insurance companies that sell crop insurance make a killing, and the risk management agency of USDA reinsures them, so they're backstopped in two different ways. So the insurance companies are doing great, and there's no conservation compliance at all tied to it. So one of the things we would really like to see happen in the next Farm Bill is some tie of conservation compliance, the requirement for implementing some conservation practices in return for receiving crop insurance. So, where are we on this track? Are we going where we want to go? And what I hope I've illustrated is that actually there's a variety of different paths we can take, that thinking purely about ag and greenhouse gas mitigation in the context of offsets programs is probably not the way to go, that also thinking about conservation practices only in a greenhouse gas mitigation context, and I'm not suggesting that we're all doing that. I'm just suggesting that there is a lot of momentum that can make it look that way, and we really all need to sort of take a step back and say, when we think about conservation practices, why are we really doing them? What if there are trade-offs? Maybe it's worth it sometimes to build more soil organic matter to have some N2O loss that you wouldn't have otherwise have. If I had to make the choice, I'd say much better to have more soil organic matter, and if I have to have a little more N2O loss in the process, no problem. I'm just going to skip to two last slides. I like this slide because it gives a nice illustration of a time horizon given by our friends at the USDA. 1860, about 150 years ago, is when USDA was established. About 100 years ago, the Extension Service was established. About 25 years ago, the Conservation Reserve Program was established. So all of what we're thinking about moving forward in terms of offset markets, in terms of this farm bill, the next farm bill, in terms of biofuels, energy policy, we're thinking about these incremental changes that we need to make soon because we've got some big problems and there's something we can do about it, but we're also thinking about what do we want this landscape to look like in 50 years and what kinds of timelines and policy changes do we want to be looking at? And that's a conversation that I think we all need to have a little bit more. My closing slide, I want you to, as I said before, comment on the Rice Management Protocol, go to the Climate Action Reserve's website. I'm quite sincere about this. I was very impressed with the level of receptivity of the Climate Action Reserve staff to input from the research community, and I was talking to them a couple of days ago, and they encouraged me to please ask you all to participate in this as well. The Rice Protocol is also fairly simple by comparison, so if you can look at that now, it'll be that much easier for you to comment on the Nitrogen Management Protocol when it comes out several months from now. And more generally, if you'd like to be more involved at the policy interface, I know many of you are plenty already, but for those of you who maybe aren't as much or have students who would like a helping hand or would like to be kept informed of where there are opportunities, we have a science network at Union of Concerned Scientists, and you can jot that down or stop by our booth or talk to me or our other colleagues who are in the audience. And thank you for your attention. I don't know if we have time for any questions or not. Okay, so let me just respond. I can't respond to everything you said. There's just too much there, but a couple. First, yes, there are certainly, you know, there's lots of attention that's been paid to trying to use these discounting mechanisms as a solution to the impermanence problem. I'm just not convinced by them. I think, please, I'm sorry, but. I think the point of food security is put it this way. Most of the corn we grow in the United States now is not used directly to feed people. And we also have a lot of food waste. 30%.
That's a policy problem. That's an energy policy problem. But anyway, we don't want to get into too much of that. I have applied some work each doing. I think it's excellent. And I think there's a lot of good benefits from carbon offsets because we're learning about verification and so on. So those are transferable to other environmental goods and services because a lot of times what we're finding is where people are paying money for things like these trades, they want assurance that the practice actually happens. So it's fantastic what we're learning here.
Thank you. And I'm sure that if anybody has questions for you, later, would you like to respond?
You know, it's a longer conversation. I will say that I've interacted a lot with the folks from the Alberta Protocol. You know, there's somebody who's had some experience with that on the working group for the Climate Action Reserve. You know, I think we have all learned a lot from that. And, you know, if you'd like to talk about it more later, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay.